Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies Podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is
Melissa Wild. I am the chair of the sociology department at the University of Pennsylvania.
And Melissa, it's great to have you here. Thank you so much for agreeing to do this. I don't know what the equivalent in email terms is of a cold call, but you replied when I wrote to you and agreed to do this, and I'm very grateful. I found that most people that I write to have no idea who I am, actually decide to participate, which is very fortunate.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure. I think it's really important to talk about my research in a way that makes it accessible whenever I can. So
lovely. Thank you. I think that's important too. So, Prof, the first question I wanted to ask you is to request that you share with us what's currently dynamizing, preoccupying, retarding, interesting. What's holding you back? What's throwing you forwards?
So lately, I have been working on a number of projects that are connected to American religious history and trying to get, I do comparative historical sociology. So by that, I mean really very systematic analyses of religious groups, very much focused on systematic analysis that allows me to answer clear causal questions. So right now I think we'll probably talk about my book Birth Control Battles at some point during our conversation.
That'd be great. Yeah.
That book actually formed the basis of a lot of data that I did not have room for in the book that I have been kind of exploring since then. And in some ways, I feel like a historical dilettante lately, in that I just published a paper on American religious groups' views on Nazi Germany and Hitler in 1935 in the British Journal of Sociology. That was the first paper that I used the data for from Birth Control Battles for something completely different.
Yes.
And that was strictly began as kind of like just an intellectual question. You know, what? So the way that I think about American religious groups is that because of the history of immigration, because of the way in which religion encompasses ethnicity and class and race in the United States, especially the way that they did a century ago, I'm able to kind of ask questions about the sort of people who held certain views on a variety of questions. Not that I think that religious groups are necessarily completely translatable to the individual level, but I am able to say, like, this group was lived in this area of the country. They came from this genetic stock. That's not the right word. Genetic stock comes from eugenics. We'll talk about that in a minute. But they came from this country. They had this class background, et cetera. And so I looked at that in relationship to Hitler, and I've begun to look at it in relationship to a number of other important historical moments. Currently, I'm working on a paper on juvenile delinquency, which is really very connected to the eugenics movement, a paper on the suffrage movement in the 1920s, and a paper on evolution. All of it's kind of circa, you know, 1920, 1930. So about 100 years ago. And I think the thing that has struck me the most as I continue to kind of just, most of it's collaborative. I work with a lot of graduate students and some undergraduates now because I'm chairing my department. So I don't have a lot of time to tackle a new book project. But what has happened is that in all of these collaborative projects, I have begun to just recognize the extent to which class, race, and ethnicity are the key explanatory variables for all of my questions. And so it's like a kind of a through line in all of these issues in a way that has really surprised me. And so I can kind of give you a quick summary of how that seems to be emerging in each of these projects, if you'd like. So in the Hitler paper, we found that, so I have 31 religious groups in my sample that represent about 90% of the American population. religious population at the time, which was the vast majority of Americans were members of religious organizations a century ago. And what I found in relationship to Hitler, for starters, was that the majority of groups, all of the groups that supported Hitler. So I fa oh, sorry, let me back up. The variation is that the vast majority of groups in the United States at the time in 1935 were simply ambivalent about Hitler. They really were not, even though there's plenty of evidence in my data that Americans were very well aware of what was happening in Germany. What really upset the majority of American religious groups at the time seemed to be Hitler's suppression of religion and his interest in creating kind of his own new, what they saw as largely pagan religion.
And just to cut in for a
They.
bit, I think Time magazine had declared him Man of the Year in maybe 1934, around that
Yeah,
period.
probably not 30. I don't think it was 35 because by 35 he had already instituted the Nuremberg Laws and it had become really clear that he was
But 34, I think
on a
he
tear.
yeah.
Yeah. But so I was initially really interested in this question because I was shocked to find that the majority of American religious groups that supported contraception in circa 1929, 1930 did so because they were eugenicists. I had no idea that eugenics was that big and that popular in the United States, even though people had talked about it. I had not. It just really, it's hard to believe until you really see the data. And so I became curious, like, so what did eugenicists think about Hitler, right? Like, it was so popular in the United States. What did they recognize that he was also a eugenicist? Were they in favor of it? What I've learned, it seems to be that they were, on the one hand, they liked that he was a promoter of eugenics, but on the other hand, they were super embarrassed by his emphasis on color. And this is a result of kind of the unique nature of race and racialization issues in the United States at the time, because the eugenics movement was largely a Northeastern movement, and they were really focused on anti-immigrant, being an anti-immigrant movement. They were very concerned about differential birth rates between native-born white Americans and Irish and Italian and Jewish immigrants. And so they were very much in the Northeast, where immigration was most common. And they very much were critical of Jim Crow and whites in the South for being racist at the exact same time that they were being very racist toward you, toward immigrants. And so, and that was really, I'm beginning to realize that was a very important part of how they could believe in eugenics, because they very much insisted that it was not racist. And in order to be able to argue that, they had to argue that it wasn't connected to color. So Hitler really threw that threw them for a loop with his focus on being Aryan. So that's where from what I could tell with the Hitler paper, that's kind of where the ambivalence came from. What was really striking about the paper, though, were the groups that were really openly arguing that the U.S. should support Hitler. And I found five out of the 31 groups that did that in their periodicals that were written, just for their members. They would say things like, well, he was democratically elected. So people calling him a dictator, that's just not accurate. Or, he's a strong man and he's standing up for Germany and he's doing what he needs to do. So there were open calls for his support. So the bottom line of that paper really was that white supremacy seemed to have been key in terms of people's support for authoritarianism. And there's a through line there, of course, like the right today and people who follow Trump are also openly white supremacist. And so that really struck me as, that we're in some ways repeating history that happened 100 years ago. Hopefully not as horrible, but very serious, right? So from the Hitler paper, I then moved to this paper on suffrage. It's the first issue connected to gender that many American religious groups had to make a pronouncement on. I really kind of didn't know for sure what the explanation was going to be about why some groups were in favor of suffrage and others weren't. Many groups were not super concerned about it the way that they were about other issues, but I was able to code them all as in terms of their views. And what I found there was that it was different, but in many ways similar, in the sense that the groups that were in favor of giving women the right to vote in the United States were the white native-born Americans who were gambling, guessing, betting that their women would A, vote the way they wanted them to, but B, be able to vote because they were citizens and they were literate, and that immigrant women would not be able to. And so suffrage was actually largely an issue, it seems to me, about outnumbering non-whites. And what's interesting about that in relationship to that kind of strange situation I mentioned in relationship to eugenics and being anti-immigrant but critical of Jim Crow in the South was that the white groups in the South were just quiet about suffrage. They said nothing because they were betting that it just didn't matter. They already controlled the polls. They weren't worried about black women getting the vote because black men already didn't have the vote. And so they just didn't say anything because they didn't want to draw attention to that fact. So that's kind of that was that's the next through line. That's a paper that I'm about to get under review. And then as that one's coming to an end, I'm working on a new one about views of evolution. And I honestly can't, I mean, partly it might, as a historian, it might just be that general ignorance. You can't possibly know everything about history. But I'm just struck by the fact that, so the evolution, the answer there is that the groups who are against evolution, so typically the story in American religious history is that the groups who were anti-evolution were fundamentalists and they were literal believers in the Bible. They did tend to be less educated. They did tend to be less Northeastern. They weren't modernists, but it's very much couched in this like theological debate. And a lot of my work as a sociologist has been, unfortunately or fortunately, to kind of emphasize the structural factors that kind of seem to be more important than theology. Although I have done work on theology. And what I learned about evolution was that the groups that were opposed to evolution, really adamantly opposed, certainly they had a fundamentalist identity, but they were white supremacists. And they could not stomach the idea that whites and non-whites of any kind shared common ancestors. So that's what's been really bothering me for a while, or kind of also illuminating much of my work. I've also been working on a lot of work on class inequality in the American religious field, and the ways in which that has been reproduced over time. And perhaps obscured because of our focus on religion as an independent force. But so those are, it's not a super fun
No,
line of research.
it's definitely not. On the eugenics front, of course, sociology was prominent in eugenics. Du Bois, big time in favor of eugenics, choose your partner in terms of their genetic history. T.H. Marshall, the big dude of social class and citizenship, addressed the Eugenic Society in Britain happily and regarded it as an honor. The Fabian Society, all in favor. Lots of Jewish groups around the world, all in favor. It got a bad name because of your non-boyfriend you mentioned, Hitler. But now there are lots of people claiming that we have what's called liberal eugenics, i.e., where the state is not manifesting a requirement for eugenics, but people are making choices about, okay, My pregnancy involves a genetic problem. I don't want to proceed with it. Right? This is what some philosophers, particularly on the right, are calling liberal eugenics. So it has a long, long history that gets altered radically because of National Socialism. Here in Spain, the Republican government had an official, before the fascist one, had an official policy of eugenics. On the other hand, once the fascist won, their top psychiatrist led a hunt for the red gene so you could breed out Marxism. So it's one of these fascinating topics to me that won't go away. It's actually with us today. It's just that it's not named as such. And it's something that has a very long, profound history in psychology and sociology, especially in the British and US contexts.
Yeah. Well, you're
So,
one of the very few people I've spoken with about my research who knows that. Most sociologists do not know that. And whenever I give a presentation on my work, they're shocked. And so it's everything you said actually is it was news to me when I started my research.
no.
And in particular, I was really surprised that I found Reform Jews were active in the American Eugenics Society, for example.
Time.
Yeah, I actually did not know what to do with that when I was in the archives. I was like, I was so puzzled at first because it flew in the face of what my working hypotheses at the time. And my knowledge of my obviously bad, poor knowledge of history. But it makes sense when you understand that eugenics was about whiteness and about class as much as it was about religion. And also there you have to know that there were two wings of the eugenics movement. One was very pro-Jewish with the argument that God could have never made his son from a Jew if Jews were not genetically perfect. And
Right.
then there was also the argument about survival of the fittest, and Jews have always been discriminated against, so they must be superior. I mean, they could come up with anything in relationship to arguments. But yes, all of that was news to me. But then, in terms of my discipline, and also in particular demography, I did not realize the extent to which the basic kind of methods of counting populations arose because they wanted to count babies and assign them to groups and to see who was having more because they were deeply concerned about race suicide.
Well, and there was a panic about Jewish women having too many babies at one point, right?
Italian, Irish Catholic, and Jewish women, yes.
Irish Catholic and Jewish women, that there would be a kind of takeover of,
And they were having about four, on average, four babies, whereas native-born white Americans at the time were having two. And the American Eugenics Society, this is where birth control battles comes into it. The American Eugenics Society figured out, at first they started just promoting positive eugenics. They were trying to get white native-born Americans to have more babies. And they realized that that was just not working. And so then they switched to focusing on negative eugenics, which was to make birth control accessible to poor women who they argued would use it if it was accessible to them, because previously
It hadn't been.
to a
But I mean,
doctor.
some of this argument is about terms we don't even use anymore, like the feeble-minded, right? And it's clear that that does articulate to race, but it also articulates to
Yeah.
rejecting what we would embrace today, and rightly,
Desirable and undesirable were big words that they used at
as
that time.
difference. No.
Yeah,
So I
special
wonder
needs.
if we could move on to your birth control book now, because it seems as though now that we're onto sex, I mean, not sex, but some of the risks and outcomes of sex, it seems sensible for us to chat a bit about this path-breaking, extraordinarily important book.
Well, thank you. It took me 10 years to write. I analyzed the American religious field from 1918 to 1965. I trace groups through that whole period of almost 50 years, with an eye toward understanding how we ended up where we are, where being a progressive American, being a progressive, in particular religious American, means that you're in favor of abortion and you're in favor of contraception. And the reverse is true for conservatives. And what I found was that it was really all about class and race. and that the groups that promoted contraception were deeply connected to the American Eugenics Society. And that, more importantly, the American Eugenics Society realized that religious groups were key lobbyists. I'm not sure of the right word. They were a key place to go and get support, but also as a kind of public campaign. They understood what I've been arguing in my work for now for 10 years, which is that religious groups really do reflect these kind of homogenous qualities in terms of ethnicity, class, geography, immigration history. And so they knew that, sure, they wanted to go and talk to the Episcopalians, because they were all white and they were all well educated. And they knew that they didn't want to talk to Catholics because they were the ones that were having too many babies, right? It's very, very simplistic examples. But so they purposefully reached out to the leaders of particular religious groups because they wanted them to, for example, talk to their constituents. And the best example of that is probably the American Eugenics Society competition for the best sermon on eugenics, which provided a lot of good data
Oh,
for
I
me.
don't know about this. Oh, good grief. I
Yes.
read much of your work. I must have missed this part of the book. My God. Okay.
It's not a big part of the book because the sermons were not focused on birth control, but what the sermons provided for me was a kind of a measure of how connected the groups that were not directly involved in the American Eugenics Society were. So how many sermons were submitted by Baptists versus Methodists versus Episcopalians? It was profound in terms of what the sermons, they very much believed that eugenics was the way of the future, eugenics would save society, and that religious groups, it was their duty to promote eugenics. Yeah. So that's kind of the book in a nutshell. Again, not another very uplifting story.
Well, and this is part of the issue where feminist heroines of the 70s and 80s, going back to the 19th, early 20th centuries, are now under reconsideration because they were eugenicists and a lot of them were racist as
Yeah.
well. And so this becomes a rewriting of white feminist history, I think. And not
Well,
only
yes, and it's not even just feminine. Yes, and it's pervasive. So, for example, I learned that Henry Pratt Fairchild was the president of the American Eugenics Society. I believe he took office in 1928. He was a sociologist, and so when I noticed that it said sociologist next to his name, I paid, extra special attention just out of disciplinary curiosity, and I Googled him. Found out that he was the president of the American Sociological Association in 1936. But what I found out about before those years was far more enlightening to me, because what I've used, the history, so but so you'll probably agree with me on this. I found the secondary historical sources about the eugenics movement to be largely extremely frustrating about why eugenics died. Like, because they just make claims about, oh, Hitler rose to power and they became embarrassed, or they became concerned, but or they lacked funding. They just kind of made very vague claims because they recognized that the movement seemed to have gone away or gone underground at least, but they couldn't exactly say why, and they didn't pinpoint a time. But it was very clear to me in the archives, which were at the American Philosophical Society in Philadelphia, so I was really lucky that they were right down the block from my house. It was very obvious that by 1929, 30, it was dying. The American Eugenics Society was like very vigorous in 26, 28, and but by 30, they had a eugenics competition, but they didn't save the sermons. There was not, there were less minutes. There was just less going on, and but there was no record of conflict, and there was no record of, say, financial concerns. It was odd, because when you see an organization dying, you can usually tell why, right? When I Googled Fairchild, I learned that in 1932, he became the first president of the Population Association of America, which is the Association for Demography. He started it. And he started it the year that he ended the American Eugenics Society. So it's far more, I really think it's a story. This isn't something that I've begun to research, really systematically, but I really think it's a story of intentional. I need to find a good metaphor for it. Academic washing, basically realizing that they had become too much of a social movement and they wanted to go back to becoming, and they wanted to be, they were safer as an
Well,
elite
if you look
discipline.
at the eugenics review, which was the British version, there's a woman who was secretary of the association that put it out for decades. And she has a very revealing piece that she writes in the late 60s about how it was a news sheet, a scholarly journal, and propaganda. And I think what's happened with some of these movements is that they've tried to become more scholarly. So the Eugenics Review is now called the Journal of Biosocial Science. In the 50s, the Annuals of Eugenics was renamed the Annals of Human Genetics. So
Same
what
in the
these
US.
people have done, and I don't mean this as a, I mean, maybe academic sleight of hand is the expression you might use. In that first generation, they were engaging in an academic sleight of hand to move from eugenics to demography and move from eugenics to genetics. Now, I think the people who nowadays are involved in demography and genetics probably have no interest whatsoever in eugenics or no commitment thereto. But that is the academic genealogy. And the question is how much of that has ever really been done away with, but also whether we are, in fact, not recognizing the reality of eugenics in our very midst. And this isn't just the awful eugenics as applied to Native Canadians, for example, that we're learning about more and more all the time. But as I said, the so-called liberal eugenics of saying, I don't want this pregnancy to continue because of
Yes,
what
in many ways, I
I'm
think with that, with the voluntary decisions on the part of many women to not proceed, absolutely, the eugenics movement in many ways would be nothing but thrilled with that outcome.
This is the complexity of it, that I hear what you say, and it challenges me in terms of some of my connections that I make about being dissatisfied with the explanations you've been given for why it isn't used anymore. But I am fundamentally satisfied with the association with National Socialism as being the reason. I mean, I need to think about that more given your challenge, I think.
I just think the timing doesn't work in terms of what I saw in the archives. And I'm a diehard
Got it.
chronological focused historical sociologist. And
No,
so
got it. And you know,
it happened before Hitler.
T.H. Marshall is addressing all this stuff in the mid-50s, so it's well after Hitler. It's still there. They haven't thoroughly washed it out or worked it out. So the trouble is, no one's left alive who can actually be interviewed by you.
True. Although I don't know if I'm okay with that. I like to study dead people because they can't disagree with me.
Helpful.
That's what I tell my students.
I like it. So, Prof, let's move on, if we could, a little way from that to Vatican II,
Oh,
which is
you did your homework.
subject of another book you've written, again, very influential, very important. Trumpeted by progressive Catholics as a great movement forward, rejected by those for whom it is apostasy, for example, Mel Gibson's father. So tell us all about it, Prof.
Well, that was a book that I wrote, I began, more than 20 years ago, we'll say. But again, the advantage of studying history is that your research doesn't become dated.
It's
What I tell my
always
students.
already dated. It's allowed to be.
Right. It's
I love
just
it.
dated. It can be difficult to get people interested in it at all because it's history, but at least it will remain relevant if you can make it relevant. So Vatican II, the question of that book and that research was really why and how did progressive change happen in this institution that is so old? And I found that there was really a two-part answer to that question. The first was, or two-part, there were two questions that had to be answered in order to answer that question. So the first question was, who wanted what and why? And then the second question was, then how did the winners win? Right? So the who wanted what and why is probably one of, I think, the most important theoretical contribution of the book, in the sense that I figured out that the nature of the countries that the bishops were coming from was crucial in terms of their prioritization of different issues. And in particular, the number one thing that determined their priorities was how religiously diverse the society was, and religious diversity as well as stability. And so, for example, the United States and many countries in Africa had similar levels of religious diversity, but the United States was a largely stable religious economy or religious organizational field by the 1960s, where, and by that I mean there was competition, but Catholics weren't super worried about losing a lot of their members to Protestants, and Protestants weren't super worried that people were going to convert to Catholicism. Like, there was stability. There was kind of just inertia, I guess. Whereas in Africa, all of the groups were basically missionaries, just kind of hitting the ground running, trying to convert as many people as they could to their religious group. And whether they lived in a religiously diverse and stable country or not really determined their focus and priorities. But all of them were, if they were in a religiously diverse place, they were progressive. It was really the countries, and this isn't news, like everyone noticed that the Italians and the Spaniards were the ones who were super conservative at the council, but kind of systematically. And one of the things that was fun about that book was that I got votes from the Vatican Secret Archive. I was the first person to ever see them, and I was the first person, that's because I was the first person to ask, as best I can tell. And I created a database of those council votes and was able to analyze the 2,500, roughly 2,500 bishops who voted on each key council vote that I studied. And the second, and that was part of the who wanted what and why. And then the second takeaway of that book was, how did the winners win? And what I found there was that it was actually progressives won because they believed in collegiality. They believed it was their responsibility to talk to each other, and that they believed the council was a holy moment, and that if there was disagreement, they hadn't quite figured out what God wanted them to do. And so they were deeply invested in working toward progress together. Whereas
This sounds like
conservatives,
Warren, sorry to interrupt for a
sorry, go
moment. This
ahead.
sounds like the Warren Supreme Court to me.
Yeah. So in contrast, the conservatives were very much hierarchically oriented. They very much were waiting to hear what to do from the curia, from the Pope to the curia on down. And they did not communicate. They did not mobilize their constituents. And I have lots of data on various petitions that show that progressives had a much greater reach, and conservatives failed to even kind of mobilize the people who had already indicated that they were in their camp previously. So,
That's
very
wonderful.
different project from birth control battles, but
You
in
know,
some
that's
ways
wonderful. It
similar.
reminds me of research into why so many basketballers in the NBA come from Philadelphia. And the reason is networking, bothering to get to know one another, connecting, taking decisions collaboratively about what to do and where to go and how to do it. I
Yeah.
think that's
Oh, the
true.
networks that progressives created at the council was insanely effective.
Right, but these bastards work out how to counter that. Think of how the Curia has centralized control, as far as I can tell, as much as possible, is trying to destroy a fairly progressive current pope, and destroy progressive tendencies wherever possible amongst the Marxist Catholics in Latin America.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I think, although one thing that I haven't studied that I think is an interesting thing to note is the extent to which the American Catholic hierarchy has become so conservative. when they were one of the main leaders of progressive Catholicism
Oh,
in the
that's an
60s.
interesting point. So now they hate people like Kerry and Biden, right?
Yes.
Yep.
And it does seem to, so this is actually fun. It does all circle back to contraception and sex.
Right.
And that is actually how I ended up writing Birth Control Battles after Vatican II, was because one of the case studies in Vatican II was about the failed reform of birth control at the council.
Right.
And in when I was looking at the data about that, a few people said, you know, we can't be in favor of contraception because that came from eugenicists and they were anti-Catholic. And I thought, oh, isn't that an interesting reason and not something you ever hear anymore? And so I was really curious about whether they were right. And that kind of got me started on birth control battles. And they
That's
turned out to
interesting.
be really right.
I had a Catholic or Catholic upbringing girlfriend in the United States who always told me, we're not Christian.
Well, she
We're
wasn't
not
quite right.
accepted. We're not
Something failed in
accepted.
her catechism class, but
We're not accepted by the other sects as Christian. We're Catholic or something else. So, Prof,
yeah.
a question about that, and this shows the crudity of my approach. When I read Weber on the disenchantment of society, I thought that that applied to religion as much as magic, and that the world was headed to a more secular view of life. So we're going back almost before you were born when I would have read that work. I was profoundly wrong, even though atheist, agnostic, no religion is the fastest growing perspective in the United States. It's still a minority perspective. And even though in places like Britain, for all that it's a horror, religion really is dying out, as it is in lots of parts of the global north, or at least it appears to be. Now, my guess is I was wrong, Weber wasn't. But how do you account for the capacity of religion to bounce back from its manifold manifest failures in terms of predicting the future or making people happy or explaining life?
Why does religion continue?
One
Is
of
that your
the
question?
concepts you work with is complex religion.
Yeah, I was just going to go there.
So share it with us so you can counter my, evil atheistic secularism.
Well, right. So what I've been talking about, these intersections between class and race and ethnicity and the homogeneity of American religious groups, I taught that. I've written some theoretical pieces about that, and when I've done so, I've argued that the way to think about it is complex religion, and by that that's kind of a nod to intersectional theory that just argues that it's very difficult to think about an independent variable and a dependent variable alone causing a relationship when you live in a complex society where many factors intersect. And my intervention has been to just emphasize the extent to which religion is both structured by inequality, but also is a structuring principle in the United States in particular. But I think that is true globally as well. And we can't really ignore the reality of religion in the current situation in the globe. And the way in which it intersects with wealth and race. Right. And I think people to some extent intuitively understand that, but they also jump to conclusions about, for example, Islam being bad without an ability to acknowledge the complex ways in which class and race and ethnicity and power intersect
Right.
in relationship to the religious groups that people are members of. And so I think that really, I mean, I'm going to be bold here, but I think religion will remain powerful as a social force, as long as inequality is powerful as a social force, as long as it intersects clearly with those key factors.
So, Prof, one way of understanding what you just said is that it distracts people from recognizing their real material conditions of existence.
Sounds very Marxist.
Guilty. Another way of interpreting what you said is that it creates, or at least enables, some of those conditions of existence, that it is a material force of its own, as well as an ideological one, if one can separate these things, that cuts up society very effectively. If I think back to the way in which, if you were Swedish arriving in the United States in the mid to late 19th century, and you didn't know anybody, and you'd heard there were some Swedes in the Midwest, you went looking for a Lutheran church because there you would find people who could speak your language, translate for you, and give you a job. But then that becomes a set of religious practices as well when you land at the church that gets passed on as actual belief rather than a handy means of survival. What do you make of that sort of explanation?
Would you repeat the question for me?
Sorry, it's long-winded and all, probably mansplaining.
It's fine.
Let me make it a bit shorter and less boring and less like a lecture. There's a history that suggests when people arrived in the US not speaking English, without a job, without networks, they looked for churches that
Absolutely.
connected with their countries in order to seek employment, love, possibilities. Is that right? And does that then lead to a latter day faith that is less based in material need?
I think so. I think, yes, absolutely. I think definitely religion has been a key place for immigrant. I want to say assimilation, accommodation, help, but as it was that, the religious groups were also focused on making sure that they kept their members within the fold, and so, Weber argues that as the generations change, they become less religious, right? That they become less world rejecting, that's part of secularization. I do think that as immigrant mobility occurred, people, and this is true, and this has been something that I've learned, way back when I was in graduate school. Herberg's Protestant Catholic Jew, it is a uniquely American. It was uniquely American for people to say to be it, for it to be one of the first questions that people asked you, what's your name, where are you from, what's your religious background, was normal. And I don't think it's normal anymore in the United States. I don't, but I think it is. I when I teach my sociology religion class, I have my students just sit back and list their five closest friends and tell me if they can tell me the religion of their five closest friends, and then the next five. And actually, they're all surprised at the extent to which they know their friends' religious beliefs, background, et cetera. So it is something people still are very open about and talk about. And I do think that that was probably a bit tangential, but I think that through that process of assimilation and generational replacement, certainly I saw it happen with eugenics, where people. The religious groups, for example, the Methodists, totally forgot why they liberalized on contraception. Same in the archives, when I went to go find, for example, the statement on contraception from 1934 from the Episcopalians, I couldn't find it. And I knew it was published in 1934, and I had to ask the archivist for it. And he said, oh, for some strange reason, that is indexed under eugenics. not contraception.
Whoa, wow.
And I said, oh, it isn't that interesting. Of course, no surprise. They didn't have any reason, they didn't have any knowledge of why. And then, the Methodists in 1960 published an article that said, we were the first to promote contraception. We were the first American religious group to promote contraception. It is our duty to continue to do so. Absolutely had no idea why. It was just what, maybe one, maybe two generations removed, but without any understanding of it. So I've thought a lot about generational replacement and how long an organization remains the same. Like how long is do leaders last, and how long is their influence, and how long do their views matter? And then also, I've also begun to think a lot about path dependency and how that can occur, even though people have no idea why. So.
Well, let me tell you a story and see if you can explain it to me. During the plebiscite in 2016 for peace in Colombia, one of the big differences between the document in favor of peace that was circulated to everybody, hundreds of pages long, and the document circulated about the plebiscite for Brexit at the same time in Britain, which was one sentence, was that this document of hundreds of pages in Colombia included statements about marriage equality and women's rights. Because of those promises, as part of the peace deal with the guerrilla, tens of millions of dollars from far-right, quasi-fascist, white US evangelicals flooded into the country in favor of a no vote. What I then saw was something racially inconceivable, which was mass protests of black and white Colombians. There is no black middle class in Colombia, essentially. Where you would see a white girl and a black boy, 18, 19, 20, holding hands. Inconceivable they would be in the same mile of one another, let alone holding hands, against a vote for peace. Because they were evangelicals and hated the idea of women's rights, which basically meant abortion, and hated the idea of marriage equality. Astonishing reach by the US evangelical movement, which poured millions into the vote for Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil also, and has tentacles all over the world. So my last question for you, Prof, before I throw to you to add anything you want, is I understand you're a sociologist and you believe in objectivity. What the fuck can be done about these people? It's scary. And it's scary because they actually know how to cross identity markers of class and race and gender. And they are frightening and they want to control everybody.
So I do believe in objective social science, but I also completely acknowledge that my own politics determine what I'm interested in. And I try very hard to, I'm very careful with the data because I know that because I care about objectivity, right? But I think my answer to that, your question, what do? You study them. You study them systematically. And here's the thing. You don't have to worry about what goes on behind the scenes. Certainly, sometimes being in an archive and seeing that, for example, the American Eugenics Society suddenly died and wondering why helps you to figure out a path, right?
They were killed off by evolution, don't you know?
But what I've learned is that people will tell you what they think. They'll put it right in front of you. And so the data is there. And I have a suggestion for another interviewee. Christopher Velasco is a sociologist at Princeton University, and he's studying exactly what you're talking about, the right-wing evangelical, largely American-based movements that who have had to reach all over the globe in an anti-trans and anti-gay movement. And he has really systematically studied that in a way that I don't think anyone else has. And it's really impressive work, in my opinion. So I think I would rather pass the baton to him to answer that
I
question
like
because
it. So I
I
can
have
do another cold email saying, "Hi, you've never heard of me, but somebody else who hasn't ever heard of me told me I should contact you."
it. Absolutely.
So,
Absolutely.
Prof, is there something else, Prof Melissa, that you'd like to add to what we've discussed? Something we've already touched on or something we've not?
No, thank you. This has been really an honor and privilege to get to talk like this for an hour. So,
Well, thank you. It was wonderful. I really appreciate it. Your work is brilliant, and it's been fantastic having the privilege to chat with you this
well,
day.
thank you, Toby. I hope I get the chance to have as much knowledge of history as you have someday because I'm very impressed.